Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
It's my great pleasure to be joined on the podcast today by Shelley Simmons. She has been a member of the Genomics England participant panel since 2017, and she's on the board of Disability Rights UK and has a background and lots of experience in governance and compliance, which she has brought to bear in this world of healthcare and advocacy. Shelley, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
I mean, I guess at the moment we're talking in January 2021, all of our lives are a bit curtailed. But paint a picture for us of your life maybe pre-COVID. What's the Simmons household like, and what does a typical week or month look like for you guys?
So in our household, we've kind of got used to a different normal anyway, aside from COVID. In 2014, our baby son at the time was diagnosed with a genetic condition called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. We've no family history. It was a complete shock out of the blue. It came because he wasn't meeting any physical milestones, so he couldn't roll, he couldn't sit, feeding was late, he wasn't crawling, all of those sorts of things. We obviously took him for tests to find out, you know, why he wasn't physically very mobile, and this diagnosis came completely unexpectedly. Just from some blood tests that he had taken, we were told he had a high CK level in his blood, which in a normal person like you and I, the levels would be between kind of 50 and 250. For Fraser, they were nearly 10,000. So on receipt of that news, we were called, you know, almost immediately to go to Great Ormond Street Hospital, where we were told that our son had muscular dystrophy at that time. They didn't know what type he had. Following that, we had months of different genetic tests because they originally thought he had congenital muscular dystrophy, of which there are many different types. So we were having different blood tests taken week by week. It was always the same story. They would test his blood. We would wait for 2 weeks. They would come back to us and say, no, sorry, nothing was identified on that gene. We're now going to test this gene. And this process, this cycle went on for, it was a good few months of this, just, you know, no, it wasn't that, we're going to try this. No, it's not that, we're going to try this.
That's really interesting. So all of the tests were, I guess, is more than guesswork. It's kind of judgment based on what the doctors can see.
Yes.
In that situation, but they're testing for a thing rather than looking at the whole picture, so to speak.
Yes. Yes. So they did that. That happened for quite a long time. When obviously all of the tests kept coming back negative, no error found on those genes, we got to the end of the line really with blood testing. And that's when my son had to have a muscle biopsy. So he had a muscle biopsy done, and the results of that took about 6 weeks to come back to us. They called us in back to clinic and they said that, I'm sorry, but your son doesn't appear to be producing a protein called dystrophin, which helps to make muscles strong, helps them to repair themselves. So that's when we were given the diagnosis of Duchenne. They had located the mutation on the dystrophin gene, and that's kind of where we've ended up.
That must have been an incredibly tough process, both for your son and for you as a family. It sounds like it really dragged on.
It did drag on. And I think for us, because our son was quite different in his presentation, which I'll come on to in a moment, we had obviously been researching, you know, when you're told something about your child, the first place you turn to is Dr. Google. You never find anything good there, but that's what you do.
It's all bad news on Google, right?
It is. But we still do it, don't we? We looked up all the different types of muscular dystrophies because we didn't know which one they were going to come back and tell us that he had. And I remember we asked specifically whether there was a possibility our son had Duchenne, because we had by this time learned that Duchenne was the most common form of muscular dystrophy in boys, but also the most severe. And obviously, you know, we had found this out. We had asked our son's clinician if he thought maybe that could be a possibility, but we were told definitely not. Your son doesn't present in this textbook fashion for Duchenne.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't worry. It definitely isn't that. And obviously, lo and behold, when you start looking deeper into the makeup of his DNA, lo and behold, that's what was found.
That's such a powerful story. And it really underlines this point that I think is a real theme in, I guess, the last kind of 10, maybe more years of, you know, the empowerment of patients and their families and communities. And one of the things that has really struck me since joining Genomics England just over a year ago is how deeply, deeply expert so many of our participants and patients are in their condition or the condition of a family member they care for. And it's incredibly impressive, and also kind of puts to bed these Victorian notions of a kind of paternalistic medical approach. They're there, you know, we're the experts, we know what's going on. It's an incredibly powerful story.
No, you're absolutely right. It's, you know, goodness knows what would have happened, you know, 40, 50 years ago if my son was presenting with these symptoms, because in no textbook, in no medical journal anywhere will you find a story like my son. So it just goes to show how far that we've come. And obviously there are people who fall outside of the norm, and that's exactly what's happened to us. And that's obviously why we are in the project, because most people entering the 100,000 Genomes Project don't have a diagnosis. And the reason Absolutely. They're entering is because they want one. Whereas in our circumstances, we've entered already having a diagnosis, but the reason we've entered is because our son is so different to other young boys who have the condition. So
it's almost as though he's an individual human being. It's crazy, right?
Who would have thought it? Yes.
The first guest we had on the podcast was actually Eric Topol, who led the Topol review of digital health and so on in the UK, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And one of his lines, which I think is really powerful, is we talk about the rare diseases as a group of diseases. We talk about the rare disease communities. Actually, every disease is a rare disease because it's in you. Yes. And I think that's such a simple but powerful framing, that we look in textbooks or in clinical guidelines and so on for the average case, but actually none of us individually is average. We're all unique in so many different ways.
Definitely.
And how did you first hear about the 100,000 Genomes Project? How did you and the family get involved?
It was one of the consultants at Great Ormond Street had said that they thought this might be beneficial for our family, because my son Fraser wasn't obviously following this standard textbook presentation for his condition. Most boys with the condition can walk in their early years of life. They can possibly jump, they can climb stairs, they can do, you know, they can meet some physical milestones. Whereas for Fraser, he wasn't meeting any physical milestones at all. And he was, you know, using a wheelchair from the age of two. So he was very different. And he does suffer as well with severe joint hypermobility, which is generally not seen in people with Duchenne. They have the opposite. Their joints are very stiff and tight.
Oh, wow.
So that obviously affected his ability to be able to walk as well. And there were just lots of things about him that were different. He had a swallowing difficulty from birth, again, not typically seen until much later in a Duchenne person's life. There were just lots of things. And they were of the general consensus, really, that perhaps he had another genetic condition going on alongside having his original diagnosis, which is when the project was suggested to us.
There must have been a lot to take in at that point. a lot of medical terminology, learning more about DNA and genomics. Like, how did you go on that journey? Like, how did you develop that understanding that you now have?
I think obviously it takes a bit of time, and at first it's all a big whirlwind and you just can't process this big bombshell that you've been given, and somehow the life that you thought you had mapped out and what things were going to be like, suddenly it's not going to be like that at all. And that obviously is the first thing that you've got to get your head around. But it is pretty crazy, really, because I think almost overnight you become a geneticist, you become a physiotherapist, you become a nurse, you become a dietitian, you become all of these things, because like you said earlier, you are the expert in this rare disease. You become the voice and the advocate, the one that fights for everything that your child or your loved one needs, and try and learn as much as you can, because knowledge really is to your power.
And in the face of all of these challenges, you have done a range of amazing things. I understand that you took Fraser to the top of Mount Snowdon on your back. Tell us about that.
Yes, this was back in 2017. I just wanted to do something with him, something that would give him the feeling of a physical achievement, which otherwise he wouldn't be able to experience, because he is a full-time wheelchair user who has extremely weak muscles. And I just came up with this crazy idea that I was going to climb a mountain, and I wanted Fraser to climb a mountain too. So yes, he was strapped to my back and we climbed up 8 miles to the top of Snowdon. We reached the top, we put a flag in the top of the mountain, and he still talks about that experience now. I mean, he was 4 at the time. He's almost 8 now, but he still talks about it. He still talks about seeing the sheep on the mountainside, and somebody was dressed as Batman, you know, going up as well. And he always talks about that. With that, we saw Batman, and it is a really, really lovely memory to have with him. And obviously his sister as well, although she didn't climb up the mountain with us, she met us at the bottom with lots of banners and you know, singing a song and saying, "Well done, Mummy, well done, Fraser." So it's kind of, you know, the whole family got something out of that experience, and it is just lovely. It's lovely to talk about it again, actually, and it's lovely to remember about it again.
Well, good on you. That's fantastic. As the father of a 9-year-old boy, I can't imagine that's something that would be easy to do at this age, but it sounds like you got it in just at the right the right moment before.
No, it wasn't easy. I mean, you know, I'm not the thinnest person in the world, I'm not the fittest person certainly, but my muscles work properly, so really, what's my excuse? And I felt like I owed it to Fraser to give him that opportunity and that experience, and I am so glad that I did it, that we did it together. We took on a challenge and we completed it together.
That is fantastic. And how did you start to get involved more broadly in, I guess, the Duchenne muscular dystrophy community, the disability rights community? How did either people find you or you find people? How did that happen?
I think probably a couple of years into all of this, post the diagnosis, I kind of realised that a lot of the skills that I had learnt in my city career were actually coming in quite handy when, you know, trying to compose emails, do some blogging, you know, make people aware of the condition, all of those sorts of things. And I realised that I had some skills that I didn't want to waste that could make a difference. And I think in the earlier days, it was all about trying to find a cure for Duchenne. I didn't want my life to be like this. I wanted a normal life like everyone else. I didn't want my child to have this condition. But I think after a while, when the acceptance came, Fraser was in a wheelchair, I guess because he was different. It wasn't a case of he was going to be in a wheelchair one day, or, you know, in 5 years' time, he was in a wheelchair today. And I think we've accepted the diagnosis and we understand a lot now about research and development, about medicines. We understand those processes. And I think for us, we just became really passionate about Fraser as a disabled person, because he's always going to be disabled. That's what his rare condition, you know, that's the effects of having a genetic condition. He will be disabled. And I think for us, it was just really important to try and change something in that space so that he has the same equal opportunities as everybody else. And being in a wheelchair doesn't have to hold you back in life. There's lots of things that you can do. And it's, I think as well, when you have got a child in a wheelchair, you actually realise how limiting the world is. Yeah. It's only until you're in that situation do you see it. And it becomes frustrating very, very quickly. So, yeah, I write about it. I blog about it. I've, you know, done different pieces of PR about it. And I just feel really, really passionate about trying to make this world accessible, inclusive and equal for everybody that lives in it. And I think I owe that to Fraser.
It's incredibly impressive, the range of activities. I'm a reasonably amateur Twitter user, and I've seen how active you are on Twitter and in other areas as well. It's very impressive. And with all of that advocacy and engagement, if you had maybe a magic wand is pushing it, but what are the 2, 3, 4 things that you think would make the most difference to either people in a wheelchair or people with different conditions more broadly?
I think probably the first thing, so going back to when we received the diagnosis, compared to some other people in the project, we've already sat in that chair opposite a consultant who has given us the worst possible news that we would ever want to hear. And I suppose when we entered the project, we unlike everybody else, we kind of don't want the project to find us something else, because that means that's something else that we have to then deal with, learn about, cope with all over again. But I think one thing that's really important to start with in somebody's journey is how a diagnosis is given to you. So I feel really strongly, and I've said this to different people before, when you sit opposite somebody and they give you that news, that is the one and only time that you're ever going to hear that piece of news. So how it's given to you is extremely important. You know, the terminology used, the sensitivity given, how those words are spoken to you, sit with you and live with you forever. And it may be to the clinician who's delivering that news, this is probably the, you know, the thousandth time they've told this news to a family, but that shouldn't make any difference to how that news is given. So I think the first thing obviously is making sure that people are given a diagnosis in the right way. So I guess for people, you know, who are wheelchair users, what would I say? I'll just try and keep my language clean. What can make a difference to them in life? It's people who aren't wheelchair users having an understanding or trying to understand what life is like when you are different. So one of the examples I will give is in a disabled toilet, which, you know, we've all used at some point. We can all be honest and say we've nicked in a disabled toilet when the others were busy. You know, that's human nature. But in disabled toilets, there's red cords. And the reason for those red cords is they're meant to hang freely to the floor, so that if somebody was in there in their wheelchair and they had fallen out onto the floor, they could have that red cord untangled, free flowing, and be able to pull it to alert somebody that they've, you know, they're hurt or they're stuck. And the amount of times I go into a disabled toilet and see it tied up because other people think it's in the way, or, you know, yeah. And it's just, it's small things like that, which I've actually written and blogged about that very example. And I've had people message me to say, oh, I went into a disabled toilet today and I saw the cord was tied up and I untied it because I read what you wrote.
And
it's just small things like that. And people not parking in disabled spaces, just, you know, I've seen it time and time again. And when you ask people why they've parked there, they'll say, I was just nipping in, or it was just for a minute. And those excuses, when, you know, when you are a wheelchair user, they become quite tiresome after a while when you've heard them time and time again. Sure. And it's just, it's those types of understandings which would be really good for the general population to have.
It's interesting. I spent about 6 weeks in a wheelchair after I broke my leg badly in a climbing accident. And it's nothing compared to someone who lives in a wheelchair long term. But even I think spending a day or 2 days in a wheelchair would just transform people's perceptions of what life is like. Because even just for those few weeks, as you say, it's looking at everyday situations in a different way. And even that completely, basically trivial experience of being in a wheelchair for a few weeks completely changed the way for the rest of my life that I've thought about either access into buildings or things that you say, like disabled loos or getting through an airport or whatever it is. And you realize how much of a difference it makes when people are helpful and thoughtful as well. Because I remember having to go through an airport for a reasonably long haul flight when I was in the wheelchair. And the fact that it was British Airways had said, right, when you get to the airport, call this number and someone will come and help you. And we'll take you actually to the really nice lounge and there's a space there for you. And then we'll help you to the plane and so on. Because I was in a wheelchair, I appreciated it so much. I felt really emotional about it. And so I think that also helping people to understand how much it means to people when you are actually helpful and thoughtful, I think was also something that really stayed with me from that experience.
Absolutely. And it's also, you know, making sure that when you're speaking to somebody who is a wheelchair user or who has a disability, whatever that might be, is talking to the person. You know, very, very often I have people say to me when I'm with Fraser, oh, how old is he? Why is he in that wheelchair? I say to them, well, you can ask him. You know, he can speak for himself. And it's that level of respect, I think, as well, that sometimes is missing.
For sure. And with Disability Rights UK, you're recently on the board there. What do you and I guess that organization more broadly hope to achieve? Like if we get some of these things right in the coming months, years, what would you like to see different in a few years time?
Actually, I think the crossover between the role obviously that I have at Genomics England and the role that I have at Disability Rights UK now, I think they're quite intertwined really, because if your aim is for people to receive a diagnosis quicker and faster, obviously they will need care and support quicker and faster. And obviously if it is a condition that's diagnosed that does cause a disability, then obviously the work that Disability Rights UK are doing around equality and inclusion, accessibility and disability rights, you know, on a grander scale, they will all become quite relevant to each other in a much more broader way. So I feel quite excited about having roles with both organisations because I feel I can make a difference.
It's incredibly impressive to do that. And I think you're right. So many of these pieces are interrelated and to have people who understand that whole ecosystem kind of playing across it is incredibly powerful. With your experience across, I guess, both Genomics England and disability rights and in other areas, what would you say to someone who has maybe just had that moment that you described of a diagnosis, either for themselves or for their child? How can they prepare themselves either practically or emotionally for the journey that lies ahead?
I think from a practical point of view, in my experience, knowledge is power, and as much information that you can get from other patients and their families, they're probably the most vital part of your whole journey. They will give you the information that will really help you. Obviously, patient organisations, have a chat to them, different things that you can do, really learn about the condition in the longer term as well, rather than just what seems overwhelming right now. It really is just trying to prepare the best you can. From an emotional point of view, I would say to somebody that it's okay to feel like your world has just come crashing down. There's no time limit on grief. Be kind to yourself and really just take each day as it comes. It took me a really long time to come to terms with my son's diagnosis. And you do almost grieve for the life that you thought you were going to have. Yeah. And that's really okay to do that. And also, people don't have to understand that because they're not living in it the way that you are. And people can say they understand or they're sorry or can I do anything to help? But at the end of the day, they aren't the person, you know, who's got to go to bed with all of this weighing on their mind each night. And yeah. It is really just about time. And I think you really do feel like in the early days that you will never be happy again. And you'll never smile again because it all just seems completely overwhelming and devastating and heartbreaking. But the truth is you do smile again and the tears become less and you do feel happy and you learn to appreciate the small things in life. So when my son did take a couple of independent steps, we cherished and worshipped that moment more than anyone else probably did when they saw their child take their first steps, because we knew that it would be short-lived. Yeah. And we knew that it might not happen again. And you do really do learn to, you see life in a different way. And I think although this is devastating to happen and, you know, you wish it hadn't happened to you, there really are some good things about all of this. And when you can see them, you'll understand exactly what I mean, but it just takes a while to get there, I think.
It's incredibly wise advice, I think, to both someone who's just had a diagnosis or about them or someone in their family, or I think, to be honest, it's just wise advice to people in life, right? It's taking that, understanding that capacity for joy and where the importance of those small things. You mentioned earlier on the community of families and individuals who are involved in a particular condition or a particular area. How have you found engaging with the Duchenne muscular dystrophy community, and any thoughts on how policymakers, researchers or others can best kind of connect into those communities and be useful?
You will find when you've got a rare disease with a small population, so in the UK there's around 2,500 people living with Duchenne, which is a relatively small number, and obviously there's rare conditions that have way fewer numbers than that. I think the easiest way to connect with parents and families and patients is through the smaller patient organisations, which are set up particularly for those specific conditions, because a lot of the time those organisations will be run by parents in this situation as well. So they are the people that really can help and connect you to others.
I guess that for a lot of them, there will be things like either websites or Facebook groups or WhatsApp groups and so on. You know, social media often gets a bad rap. It strikes me that this is maybe one of the areas where it's fulfilling maybe its kind of purest mission. I mean, have you found that, or any thoughts on social media in the space?
Oh, definitely. I mean, social media, it can be obviously a curse, but it can also be quite a true blessing, especially if you do find yourself in a situation like this, because I guarantee you, you will find somebody in the same situation as you. They'll, you know, without a doubt, there will be groups set up for your particular condition, your diagnosis. There's groups set up for people who don't have a diagnosis. So if you've entered a project like this and nothing has come back yet, you will be able to find people like you. If, you know, people want to talk, and people are more than happy to connect with you, to feel like they're trying to help people. They nobody knows what it feels like to be in this situation unless it's happened to them, and that is what you will find on social media. You will find people like you.
There you go. And that kind of connectivity, I guess, or community is so important at these times of such huge struggle, right? I guess we as humans, as social animals, rely on each other in ways that are pretty profound. From the community back to your family for a second, if we can. I think that I'm right in saying there's a website around Fraser and the family and telling a bit more of the story. Tell us a bit about that project and how people can find out more if they're keen to.
So we set up a Facebook page for Fraser. In the earlier days, it was about fundraising and those types of things, but it's kind of, I guess it's evolved a little bit with how I've evolved, because I'm the person that runs the page. Now, yes, we document about Fraser's appointments and how he personally is doing, but also now we've kind of expanded it out to give people more of an education, I suppose, about what it is like to live with a rare disease, what it is like to live with a disability. So we will talk and blog about things like the red cords in the toilets, which I mentioned earlier. We'll talk about access to buildings, stairs, how people can be more inclusive and how they can look at things differently. So it's become a lot bigger than I thought it would become. We've now got 13,000 followers, so there's potential there to reach quite a big audience, which is really good. And I do find when you do write something which strikes a nerve with someone, you have lots and lots of replies from people all over the world. We've had people engage in our posts from Australia and Thailand and Africa and places all over, to say, yes, they're in the same situation, I completely understand you, this is what happens here. It's become, I guess it was an outlet for me to start with, but now I feel like it's got a greater purpose of actually providing people with information and an education, and trying to make, I guess, other people in our situation not feel like they're completely alone. So I obviously enjoy writing, and I'm hoping my career as a company secretary who has written minutes all of her 20-year career has now come in handy for that purpose.
It's all paying off. And if people are keen to find you online, what should they search for?
So on Facebook, if they search for Fraser and Friends, they will find the page. It should pop up. And if Fantastic. You want to follow me on Twitter, it's @Shelley_Simo.
Simo, S-I-M-M-O. Super. Shelley, that's an incredibly inspiring story. I mean, it seems to epitomise the old thing about when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. And I think the amount of inspiring work that you're doing and with disability rights, with Fraser and Friends, is hugely encouraging and inspiring for many people. So thank you so much for that. And thank you for taking the time today. Really, really appreciate it. And great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.